Tanta Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Princess Margaret by Helen Cathcart, narrated by Lorna Bennett. 1. The Surprise Princess. A month now since the Duchess of York announced her retirement, yet the Yorks were at Covent Garden with the King and Queen to see Dee Fledermaus. To judge prenatal influences, this child will be musical, artistic, imaginative. Family Correspondence, May 1930. 1. In the early spring of 1930, the ceremonial secretary of the Home Office found it difficult not to tell his wife the enticing news that the young Duchess of York was expecting another baby. The birth of a future possible heir to the British throne seemed to him a matter of great moment, and travelling between Whitehall and his home near Sloane Square, Mr. Harry Boyd hugged the gratifying thought that he was among the few to be entrusted with the secret outside the royal family. He was indeed the only man in the ministry with experience of how these affairs should be handled. When the request had arrived from Buckingham Palace that the Secretary of State for Home Affairs should hold himself in readiness to attend the Duchess of York at any hour between August 6th and 12th next, Mr. Boyd had personally taken the letter to his chief along the corridor. As it happened, Mr. J.R. Clines had been in office less than a year with Ramsay MacDonald's second Labour government. Harry Boyd explained that it was traditionally incumbent upon the Home Secretary to be technically present at the royal birth, and Mr. Clines replied in his quiet, shy way, "I know nothing of these things. I shall leave them to you as far as possible." On April the 16th, the news was made public. The court circular appeared with the announcement, "The Duchess of York has cancelled her forthcoming engagements and she is not undertaking any further functions during the summer," and Mr. Boyd felt free at last to recount everything to his lady. Having no children of their own, the Boyds liked to involve themselves in the family events of others, and now here they were, or rather Harry was, at the heart of a royal domestic occasion of the happiest consequence. The new baby might prove to be King George V's first grandson in the male line of succession, and, in view of the preponderance of boys in both the Windsor and Strathmore families, public and private opinion evidently regarded this as a certainty. Ada Boyd glowed on seeing the Duke and Duchess of York with the King and Queen one Saturday night at Dee Fledermaus at Covent Garden, and the audience rose to give the Duchess a warm ovation, as if in fervent greeting to a prince. Circumspect as he was, Harry Boyd felt his stock rising among his friends on the fact that he had similarly been present 4 years earlier at the birth of Princess Elizabeth. "It simply means a lot of waiting about," he said, with more prescience than he knew. The Duchess had chosen then to have her first baby at the London home of her parents, 17 Bruton Street. The Home Secretary in Mr. Baldwin's government on that occasion had been Sir William Joynson Hicks, and, at Mr. Boyd's insistence, they had arrived in the rain at Bruton Street shortly after breakfast, and had remained to lunch and dinner as the day wore on. "If there have to be gentlemen waiting outside my bedroom door," the little Duchess had said, with a glint of mischief, "I hope it's someone we know." So the story goes, with the undoubted grain of truth that Mr. Boyd gained his ceremonial appointment not many months before Princess Elizabeth was born, and was a kinsman by marriage of the Duchess of York's eldest brother, both having found brides in the Osborne family. At all events, Mr. Boyd realised Lady Strathmore had pleasantly made him feel at home as one of the family. The anxious vigil with the young Duke of York had lasted into the small hours until, at 2:40 a.m, Princess Elizabeth uttered her overdue first cry, and the doctors, the yawning Minister of the Crown and the sleepy civil servant, could presently go home to bed. For a few carefree weeks in 1930, Mr. Boyd imagined that the young mother would decide to await her second child at 145 Piccadilly, the York's official London residence, and very appropriate, too, he considered, if a future king should be born in a mansion overlooking Buckingham Palace. Then, on a warm evening in May, the Duke and Duchess dined with the King and Queen, George V and Queen Mary, and Mr. Boyd gathered a topic of their conversation a few days later when he learned that the Duchess was proposing to have her baby at her parents' Scottish home, Glamis Castle. "But this will never do," he told Mr. Clynes in high consternation. "The difficulty of the arrangements, so far away, what will people think?" When a Home Office colleague suggested that he and the Home Secretary could take hotel rooms in Perth, the meticulous Mr. Boyd was patently horrified. "Supposing the bath should occur in the early hours of the morning, and the Home Secretary could not get to Glamis?" The palace recommended that he should talk it over with Lady Airlie, Queen Mary's close friend, who lived 8 miles from Glamis at Airlie Castle, and was then in London. In her intended memoirs, Lady Airlie wrote of the small, anxious-looking man who confronted her, agitated lest the seclusion of Glamis should give the people the impression that everything was going to be conducted in an irregular hole-and-corner way, as he put it. "If this child's birth is not properly witnessed, its legal right might be questioned. It has happened before in history." And to Lady Airlie's utter astonishment, he produced a book with passages marked in red ink on the birth of the son of James II and Mary of Modena, and the supposed substitution of a changeling son as heir to the throne, alleged to have been smuggled into the bedchamber in a warming pan. "We must not risk anything of that sort," said Mr. Boyd, in all solemnity. An obvious solution was for the Home Secretary to stay at Glamis Castle itself, that vast ancestral pile where in more ample days beds had once been made up for 88 guests. On this prospect, Mr. Boyd met a curious silence, impregnable and loftily distant as its ancient slate turrets. With hindsight, one considers that the young husband concerned, the Duke of York, had doubted the legal necessity of the Home Secretary's presence ever since that day and night vigil for Princess Elizabeth. "I always wanted him to come up when he was sent for, which would have been so much simpler," he privately wrote from Glamis. Convinced in his own mind that his elder brother, the Prince of Wales, would one day marry and settle down, perhaps in a year or two after becoming king, he felt it would be time enough then for the cradle protocol. But who could indeed foretell the misty future? It was not until the following year, in May 1931, that the prince first met Mrs. Simpson, and so began treading the path of fate that led to the abdication. While his father reigned, the Duke of York could not question the constitutional need for observing the old custom of attendance. But in due course, as King George VI, he learned that in reality, no law or statutory requirement existed to give it substance, and before the birth of Prince Charles in 1948, he was to abolish the archaic practice merely by announcing that he felt it unnecessary to continue further. Impelled by Mr. Boyd's fervour, however, Mr. Clynes accepted an invitation to stay at Airlie Castle, and he left London on August the 4th, the 30th birthday of the expectant mother. Whatever his illusions about the Scottish aristocracy, and as a former cotton mill piecer he may have held many, he was enraptured by the homely quality of Lady Airlie's hospitality, and wrote with gusto of the Scottish teas and fresh-baked scones, the game pies and freshly caught trout. Airlie Castle is in fact the smallest occupied castle in Scotland, little more than one room and a corridor thick, and in those days there were only 2 spare rooms for visitors. Mr. Clynes's detective had to be lodged in a nearby cottage, and when Mr. Boyd gazed up doubtfully at the single wire rigged up between Airlie and Glamis for telephone calls, accommodation also had to be found in the neighbourhood for an army dispatch rider with a motorbike to stand by day and night. Yet the homely Mr. Kleins delighted in everything. The oil lamps lit at dusk, the kettles of hot water, the family atmosphere. At a luncheon party at Glam's, the Duchess of York apologised charmingly for having brought him so far. "We are so sorry you missed my birthday party, but now you are keeping us all in birthday mood." The mood nevertheless grew strained as the days went by, still without the awaited infant prince putting in an appearance. No one seems to have contemplated any prospect except that the baby would be a boy, a future male heir, third in line to the throne. The estate had to be put almost in a state of siege, Mr. Kleins noted, and some of the sensation-mongering tourists were roughly treated by dour tenantry. Mr. Boyd, meantime, fretted and fussed. On the 10th, he met Sir Henry Simpson, the royal accoucheur, and sat up all night on being assured that the child would certainly be born on the 11th. The word spread, and on the summit of Hunter's Hill overlooking Glam's, the brushwood was piled high for the beacon fires to greet a Scottish-born prince. On the 14th, Lady Airlie recorded, Mr. Boyd was in a panic and reminded the Home Secretary so severely of his duty when he was on the point of going out for a drive that we returned to the house to sit making conversation. Yet still, nothing happened. On the 21st, the ceremonial secretary was wild-eyed and haggard after sitting up all night, leaping to his feet when the Duke of York's comptroller telephoned from Glam's, only to report that there was still no news. It rained all day, and in the evening, a fantastic sunset began to break against the clearing sky. When the telephone rang again,
"What? In an hour? You haven't given us much time."
Lady Airlie heard Mr. Boyd's anguished cry. When they set off pell-mell in the car, Mr. Kleins was so moved by the pageantry of the crimson clouds that he launched into poetry.
"Look at that sunset! In such a night, Troilus, methinks, mounted the Trojan walls."
The roads were wet, and their local police driver wary of skidding, but to Mr. Boyd's lasting satisfaction, they were still in time. The tower clock had just struck 9, and on the other side of the castle, in a bedroom overlooking the private garden, the baby was delivered 22 minutes later.
"A doctor came down to me and asked me to go to an anteroom," wrote the Home Secretary, "where the Duke of York, the child's grandmother, another doctor, nurses, and a few privileged persons were waiting."
The little scene occurred, in fact, in the tapestry or music room, more recently used as a billiard room, where he was shown not the expected infant prince, but a baby girl who might one day be a queen. And with impressions tinged more with romance than with realism, he added, "She was lying perfectly still and evidently content, in a cot, her wide-open eyes looking with apparent interest at the strange new world." 2. The expected boy was a girl, a 6-pound, 11-ounce princess, and apparently the only person not taken aback was Mr. Boyd. He had an alternative telegram ready to send to the Lord Mayor of London and to the long list of 56 Governors-General and governors of the Dominions and Crown Colonies. He had only to amend his draft of the first bulletin. Yesterday evening at 9:22, Her Royal Highness the Duchess of York was safely delivered of a princess at Glam's Castle. His Royal Highness the Duke of York and the Countess of Strathmore and Kinghorn were present. Mr. Secretary Kleins was also present. To which the doctors, Scotsmen all three, gleefully added the phrase, "Her Royal Highness and the infant princess are doing fine." South of the border, the homely Scottish phrase was primly amended to, "are doing perfectly well." Next morning, the bells of St. Paul's pealed over Fleet Street, although in those more leisurely days,
the news had missed the earliest editions. Said the Times, "There will be some natural disappointment that the baby is a girl and not a boy, but she is nevertheless sure of a loving welcome." A royal salute of 41 guns boomed from the Tower of London, echoed by the guns of the Royal Horse Artillery in Hyde Park, where, as the Times meticulously recorded, the men in the crowd doffed their hats and the onlookers cheered heartily for the princess and her mother. As the wireless news went out, Mayfair grew suddenly festive with flags on its shops and clubs. The bells of Westminster Abbey, and indeed of Dundee and elsewhere, pealed in greeting. In the county town of Forfar, 8 miles from Glamis, the great 300-year-old bell of Forfar rang at breakfast time. And at noon, the borough council drank the unnamed royal baby's health as the youngest Forfarian. Whereupon the oldest Forfarian, the 90-year-old town clerk, equally proposed the toast, "The Princess Elizabeth." Meanwhile, at Glamis, that young lady, aged 4 and 4 months, had been taken to see baby sister and, of her own accord, had responded sweetly by collecting together all her choicest toys in a petticoat and heaping them around the baby's cot. That night, Elizabeth is supposed to have been lifted to a castle window to see the flames of the beacon burning in her sister's honour. But in reality, the torches were not applied to the brushwood until 9:45 p.m., and one doubts whether a 4-year-old would have been taken from her bed merely to see the twinkle of a fire 2 miles distant. Throughout the evening, on the other hand, cars and coaches were bringing lively crowds from as far away as Edinburgh and Aberdeen. At sunset, the Glamis Pipe Band in its Strathmore tartan piped the celebrating throngs along the muddy tracks to the top of Hunter's Hill, where 2 barrels of beer were broached for the estate workers, the foresters and ploughmen, by the factor Mr. Ralston. The bagpipes played Highland Lassie and the Duke of York's Welcome. The torches were the selfsame ones used to light a similar beacon for the Duke and Duchess's wedding 7 years earlier, and all the young folk of the district danced and sang around the flames. Next day, a bulletin announced the satisfactory progress of mother and child, and at the weekend, the doctors were still reassuring the anxious that the Duchess of York had enjoyed another excellent night's sleep. More to the point was an amendment to Lilibet's, Princess Elizabeth's, favourite family game of three bears, in which her father was the big bear, her mother the rather big bear, and herself the little bear.
"Now we can play four bears," she announced. "The baby will be the very little bear."
And into the month of September, indeed, the new baby had no other title, save for the cooing endearments of her innumerable aunts and uncles. Intent on a son, the young parents had deliberately neglected to consider what they should call a girl, lest it should tempt the fates.
"I think that Anne of York sounds pretty,"
the Duchess wrote to Queen Mary when her daughter was 6 days old.
"Lots of people have suggested Margaret, but it has no family links really on either side."
Charles, the name of her maternal grandfather, might have been her choice, I think, if she had been given a son. Yet Margaret buoyantly surfaced of its own accord in the certainty of Scottish public opinion. There had been a queen or princess of that name in Scotland almost an unbroken line, from the saintly wife of King Malcolm Canmore, the mother of 3 Scottish kings, through 5 centuries, until the great-grandson of Margaret Tudor became James VI, King of Scots, and James I, King of England. No heir so close in the British succession had been born in Scotland since the day in 1600 that saw the birth of Charles I. Scottish newspapers were quick to remind their readers that the Duke of York was also titular Earl of Inverness, and that the new princess was descended from the united powerful Scottish elements of Strathmore, Kinghorn, and Bowes Lyon.
"I am very anxious to call her Anne Margaret," the Duchess wrote to Balmoral mournfully. Elizabeth and Anne go so well together.
The king, however, did not agree, and the intended Margaret still lacked a name, on August the 30th, when the king and queen called at Glam's, to see their latest granddaughter. "The baby is a darling," Queen Mary noted in her diary. Another week slipped away, until on September the 6th, the Duchess wrote to her mother-in-law with some firmness,
"Bertie and I have decided now to call our little daughter Margaret Rose, as Papa does not like Anne. I hope that you like it. I think that it is very pretty together."
The name also prettily complimented her nearest sister in her own family, Lady Rose Bowes Lyon, who was 10 years her senior. It had a romantic ring, English and Scottish alike, a Rose of York, a Margaret born at Glam's, both unerringly popular. There remained only one final official hurdle. Under Scottish law, the birth of the princess should have been registered within 21 days, except under payment of a penalty or fee. The local registrar of Glam's, Mr. Charles Buchanan, who combined the role with that of village postmaster, postcard vendor, and proprietor of the local sweet store, thought that he detected the reason for delay. Only 12 local births had been registered in his book that year, and the new Princess Margaret Rose would be the 13th. A man of resource, however, Mr. Buchanan sent off a postcard to a Mrs. Jevena Brown, whose baby boy, George, had been born within 3 days of the princess, and she was persuaded to register the birth of her son forthwith. The practical wife of a tenant farmer, Mrs. Brown was not superstitious, and accepted Certificate 13 without a qualm. But it was not until September the 30th that Mr. Buchanan was summoned to Glam's Castle to receive his shilling fee for registration of the birth of Margaret Rose, and to give in return Certificate 14. In the care of her nurse, Mrs. Knight, formerly nanny of Lady Strathmore's younger children, and of the Duchess of York herself, the new princess crossed the border 3 weeks later on the night train to London. By early morning, the news of her coming had spread, and an unusually large and warmly curious crowd welcomed her at St. Pancras Station. Not that they caught more than a passing glimpse of the wide-awake baby. On the pavement outside number 145 Piccadilly, the London home of the Duke and Duchess of York, a small flock of newspaper cameramen were waiting hopefully. But the cobbled forecourt beyond the tall iron railings remained royally sacrosanct, and the tall moustached policemen stood like sentinels. At 10 weeks old, Princess Margaret Rose was christened by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Lang, amid the flowers and potted palms of the old and rather ugly private chapel of Buckingham Palace, which the Nazi bombers were to oblige us by demolishing less than 10 years later. The baby wore the creamy robe of Spitalfield silk and Honiton lace, used for all royal baptisms since the firstborn of Queen Victoria. The gold-plated lily font was brought up from Windsor, and the flagon of Jordan water came from what was then the troubled British-administered territory of Palestine. Though ornate in setting, the ceremony was essentially a private family occasion. There were no crowned heads, save two of the grandparents, King George V and Queen Mary. The official sponsors were the Prince of Wales, the later Duke of Windsor, Princess Victoria, sister of George V, Princess Ingrid of Sweden, Lady Rose Lucien Gore, and David Bowes Lyon. Put so briefly, the godparents seemed unadorned by any baptismal traits of significance, yet the Prince of Wales found himself occupied elsewhere and was represented by his young brother, Prince George, the popular father of the Duke of Kent. Princess Victoria was a saddened spinster who had moped for years after being forbidden to marry the man she loved, a commoner. Princess Ingrid, the Queen Mother of Queen Margrethe of Denmark, could not attend, and her proxy was Lady Pat Ramsay, who had been the first of the modern Westminster Abbey brides when, as Princess Pat, far removed from the throne, she had indeed happily married a commoner in 1919. Lady Rose Lucen Gore, to whom the baby was niece and namesake, was the Duchess of York's sister, the former Rose Bowes Lyon, and subsequently Countess Granville, who, as Aunt Rose, was ultimately to live in Kensington Palace and deeply attract Princess Margaret to the charms of this London environment. Then there was David Bowes Lyon, youngest of all the Bowes Lyon brothers, an extra Uncle David to smile on the scene. The christening gifts, indeed, jackets and silver spoons, tiny slippers, rattles and toys, were tokens of family kinship or friendly affection, more than symbols of regal birth. The Times also noted the presence of 4-year-old Princess Elizabeth, obviously well surrounded by members of Their Majesty's household in waiting. Many of the christening guests had also been at Victoria Station that morning, safely seeing off Queen Victoria's 80-year-old son, the Duke of Connaught, on his way to the warmer climes of the Riviera. Immediately below the announcement of the christening, a special correspondent reported that the Duke of Gloucester had presented a gold sceptre to the newly enthroned Emperor of Ethiopia, and the next column surely enshrines the royal atmosphere of the day in announcing a speed limit of 20 miles an hour in the royal parks. Police and park keepers have received instructions to enforce this limit rigorously, the announcement fulminated. Determined in the interests of users of the parks and of residents in the neighbourhood to use all possible means to prevent abuses by motorists whose inconsiderate conduct in the past has frequently been a source of annoyance and danger. Motorists using the royal parks would be well advised in future to keep within the speed limit. This was indeed the year 1930, and the world of the little princess was hedged in truth by gold sceptres and policemen, keepers, speed limits, and well-meaning advice. 3. In those days, number 145 Piccadilly was one of a terrace of stone-faced mansions, impressive and outwardly aloof, that looked southward over the plaza of Hyde Park Corner. It stood a little to the east of Apsley House, where the endless stream of London traffic now swings southward from the park, and whenever Princess Margaret passes nowadays, she sees the red buses, the cars and trucks grinding across the site of her childhood home. Difficult to grow used to seeing a traffic island at the very spot where, in indoor quiet, she once played with her toys at her mother's feet. Difficult not to sense a twinge of the heart at the recollection of friendly 145, in another dimension of time, the budgerigars chirping in the hall, and the staircase coiling towards the nursery world on the fourth floor at the top of the house. The young Duke and Duchess of York had been married only a year when they first viewed the house, then untenanted and dilapidated, with a warren of 25 bedrooms somewhere beyond the temperamental electric passenger lift. "What should we do with 25 rooms?" the Duchess had inquired. But a number were mostly so small or ill-shaped that sets of two had to be knocked into one, and others adapted as bathrooms, dressing rooms, and wardrobes. With such changes, the house instantly became less cumbersome and more congenial. With the introduction of double glazing, then a great novelty, it also became pleasantly quiet and tranquil. The assorted attics of the fourth floor blossomed into a nursery world, opening onto a bright, glass-domed central landing destined to offer future stabling for 30 toy horses. The sunny day nursery overlooked the busy traffic of Piccadilly, and the night nursery at the back enjoyed morning vistas across the park. On the ground floor, a so-called ballroom with an outmoded conservatory became a spacious morning room, with French windows unexpectedly opening onto a garden shared with the neighbours. And this amenity, in turn, later proved useful when the two princesses were old enough to play with the next door.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?